The Big Picture, a Christian insight into the world of movies, television and pop culture with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley. A Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's word into every corner of your world.
Ahoy mateys, I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm his choreographer, Mark Hadley. Welcome to episode 41 of The Big Picture for the week beginning December 6th. And coming up in today's show, well, it's the biggest in boxing. Sylvester Stallone climbs back into the ring for the Rocky sequel, Creed.
The tallest fishing tale around, Ron Howard shows us his version of Moby Dick with In the Heart of the Sea.
And the glamest of the glam, the Eurovision Song Contest, Kid Style.
Speaking of glamorous of the glam, Mark Hadley, good to see you, my friend. How's things? You all right?
If only I'd worn my sequin shirt. Yeah, mate, I'm fine. Thanks very much.
I'm yourself. Amazed you did it. It's a Sunday night. You tend to?
Because normally I like to kick back with a bit of sequin and flared trousers.
Who doesn't? Let's be honest. It's a Sunday night.
Oh, it's never a waste.
No, that sound effect has not ever been a waste. That's
okay.
True.
All right, this week in film, Ben.
Right, at cinemas this week, we're about to talk about a bunch of new releases a little bit later on the show, but one of them that we're not going to talk about in detail is The Night Before, which is this bromance set at the Christmas time of year, starring Seth Rogen, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and Anthony Mackie from The Avengers. They're three lifelong mates who have got this Christmas Eve tradition of going out, hitting the town and getting on it, and they're doing their one last swan song because they've grown up and they've got older. Well, they haven't really grown up, and that's the thing with this sort of movie. If you've seen any movie with Seth Rogen, you know what tends to ensue is what happens in this movie. So there's a lot of smart, a lot of these sexual jokes, a lot of man boy guys trying to grow up, not really, a lot of drug addled stuff, etc., etc. Some of it's funny, a lot of it you've seen all before. The best thing about this movie, I think Michael Shannon co-stars in it. He's almost worth seeing it just for that fact. But again, go back to what I said about The Night Before. There's a big caution around the offensive material that transpires in The Night Before. And big word of warning.
Speaking of big cautions, tonight actually on SBS 835, Finding Jesus, Faith, Fact, Forgery. A fascinating new insights it's billed as into the historical Jesus, utilizing the latest state-of-the-art scientific techniques and archaeological research. New? Hardly. It's about the Shroud of Turin, venerated parts of the original cross, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene again. Look, this is controversies that have probably been dug up, you know, every 5 years, and the fact that it's on at Christmas is kind of a little opportunistic. Be aware, this is the sort of thing that's probably going to annoy most Christians.
Mark, there's a big box set releasing this week on DVD and Blu-ray, the Mission Impossible box set. All five of Tom Cruise's spy efforts have been lumped together into one place. I don't know why after the first movie they didn't start calling this missions like kind of impossible but not really, it's probably going to happen, which I know is a long title and won't actually fit on the box set, I grant you, but
Mission Probable.
Well, after they discovered that the first Mission Impossible was actually possible, I just thought that would kill your title.
One of the fifth one, it probably should have been Mission Yeah.
So Mission Yeah, the box set is out now.
Okay, well listen, in news this week, Steven Spielberg has revealed that he intends to make a fifth Indiana Jones film. He's come right out really strongly and said, I will never replace Harrison Ford in the title role. His quote, I don't think anyone could replace Harrison as Indy. I don't think there's ever going to happen. There's only going to be one actor playing Indiana Jones, and that's Harrison Ford. Now, so are we clear? There's a lot of rumors that came out that Chris Pratt from, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy,
Jurassic World,
Was actually going to step into the role, and that was actually a really exciting thing, but now Harrison is locked in as far as Spielberg is concerned.
What if Harrison Ford just wants to retire? Like, Steven Spielberg's not going to let him. When he's 90, he's going to come knocking on the door saying, Harrison, get out, get the whip, get the hat on, we're going.
What if he should? Has anyone seen the fourth Indiana Jones film? I mean, really, Crystal Skull? Oh, Harrison, please.
Wow. Okay, well, for some news about one aging film star to another, Bill Murray. Bill Murray has reteamed with director Sofia Coppola. They made the excellent drama Lost in Translation a number of years ago.
Big thumbs up.
They're back for a weird-sounding holiday special called A Very Murray Christmas, which is debuting on Netflix. There's Bill Murray playing himself around Christmas time. I presume he's like sitting around the piano and singing Christmas carols. But all these laundry list of celebrity mates are showing up. George Clooney, Amy Poehler, Michael Cera, Chris Rock, Jason Schwartzman, even Miley Cyrus is showing up at A Very Murray Christmas. You can check it out on Netflix. I think I will be.
Okay, well, listen, let's get right into the show. Our first segment is What Your Kids Are Watching. And in this one, it's somewhat a bit of an after the effect, what your kids are watching. What was once an international joke has become a worldwide smash. The annual Eurovision Song Contest is a bizarre yet beloved spectacle of pop music, cheesy choreography, and, let's face it, wind machines.
Wind machines.
You've got to have them. Did you know that there's all also, though, a junior Eurovision. Ben watched this year's mini music fest and was toe-tapping about its celebration of, well, really weird kids and its sequin challenge of the desire to mock.
Mark, by now that you know that was My Girls by the Australian singer Bella Page, why an Australian is performing in junior Eurovision, repeat, Eurovision, who knows, apart from Australia has recently become obsessed with things, all things Eurovision. At the most recent adult Eurovision, Guy Sebastian was the first Australian performer. SBS has got on board the past couple of years, done an amazing job with their coverage and commentary on Eurovision Spectacular and now into the junior Eurovision as well, to this extent where the last couple of years, my wife Amy and I have got on board, and when you start out watching it as a bit of a joke, it's become a little bit of an annual thing where we get some friends around and really enjoy the spectacle that is watching Eurovision.
So the Eurovision party?
Yeah, and the countdown at the end of like who's going to win and all that kind of stuff. And usually like on the show, we talk about things on TV that are ongoing. It's a bit weird that we're talking about Junior Eurovision given it happened a week ago.
Yeah, actually they deliberately program it too to the fact that people can have those sort of Eurovision parties. But what about the kids version? I mean, how does that work with watching children, that sort of...
We really quite enjoyed it. It's very similar to the adult one. Everything from the song choices and the kind of lyrics, you get loads of stuff about peace and love and unity and understanding, and then also really vague, especially in the English translation of just what exactly are you singing about? I don't follow you, little man. We really liked the fact that not all of them were super polished, really photogenic, the kind of star kids that you expect on this kind of program. Like Bella Page is a good example, the Australian girl. She was a contestant on The Voice in Australia, and that's why she got up across on Junior Eurovision. There are a lot of kids like that. There's sort of kids that you just expect to be in the limelight. But then there were these other goofball kids that were just a little bit kooky, a little bit weird. Some of them were slightly overweight. Some of them weren't as attractive as you might have expected. And there are even some girls in the choreography, the backup dancers, that looked like they just pulled them out of the crowd because they had matching sneakers on. And they were just doing these moves that they seemed to have just made up in their heads. And they were marching to their own drum. It was awesome. Right. So there was slightly a celebration on Junior Eurovision of kids being kids. On an international scale, we loved it. I like that more than the serious stuff, like the kids hang, like that serious stuff where kids are singing these massive power ballads about lost loves. It's like, dude, you're 11.
Okay, well, what was the effect on you? I mean, when you watch something like, were you able to sustain your mockery all the way through, or did you start looking at a program differently because kids were
very
involved?
Very differently. I'm glad you raised my mockery because I, like plenty of other people, I'm sure, watching Eurovision and Junior Eurovision, you go in just to mock. You want to make fun of the big hair, the wind machine, the sequins, the effects, the ridiculous songs, the outlandish emotion, all that kind of thing. But particularly when you're watching kids, that's a difficult line to sustain. And I'm not even arguing for people to sustain it. I think, myself included, we've got to ditch the mockery and stop just tuning in to watch people fail and watch, like, be smug about thinking you're better than this person, all that kind of thing. It's that sort of thing. It's a very difficult thing against any other person, let alone kids. And so watching Junior Vision, I found that a massive correction to myself. I recently heard about a woman, a female writer, who decided to spend 2 weeks not criticizing or complaining. And what she did was pray more instead. She decided, instead of pouring her gripes out against the world and like really trying to feel superior to everybody else, she would humble herself in front of God. And
wow.
That's the kind of thing I think I was trying to think about during Junior Eurovision. How can I turn this around? One of the other big things I liked about Junior Eurovision was there was a contestant from the Ukraine. I think she was a Christian, and some of the lyrics she had in her song were really powerful and struck my wife Amy and I as like, I think she might be a Christian. I read her bio. She thanks God for her God-given abilities. What Junior Eurovision then this year gave to me was showing there was a platform for a young girl to use her God-given abilities. And I thought that was an amazing thing to see on an international stage. So at very least, Junior Eurovision celebrated kids of all kinds of different aspects, and particularly this one young girl who used her talents for good, for God, at an international level. Nice
that's,
one.
That's fantastic. Well, look, Junior Eurovision has been and gone, but you can buy the songs online, and if you really want to relive the Euro times, expect the Blu-ray and DVD release pretty soon.
Now, Mark, we're all over the Facebook and the Twitters, and this week on the Facebook and Twitters, there is a special Eurovision bonus extra
that's
for
true.
The fans
that's
out there.
That's true, that's true. Our producer for The Big Picture has actually been involved in two Eurovision spoof videos, so unbeknownst to her, we're going to put them up on the Facebook page, because we figure she'd love to be exposed that
way. Not laughing at, laughing with.
Laughing with.
Exactly
no
right.
No mockery here. Look forward to that. And look, if you've actually got a Eurovision something that you'd like to contribute on the Facebook page, let us know. We'd love to see it up there.
Please do. Now, coming up on the show, Mark, we've got another Eurovision selection, and we're also going to dive deep into the world of In the Heart of the Sea and the latest Rocky film, Creed.
Welcome back. Well, it's Eurovision. That's what we've been talking about up to date on the show, and so we figured, why not actually make in soundtrack this week Eurovision one of our key sort of planks. So here's a song that is in fact so quintessential Eurovision, it was actually named the most quintessential Eurovision song by a musicologist at the University of Bristol. Apparently it's got the requisite amount of hair flicks and dance moves to
you
actually
can really
make
hear
it
the wind machine.
And it was the 50th anniversary celebration of the Eurovision Song Contest that named this song the best song in the competition's history. I bet you know it. Can't actually listen to ABBA without being taken back to the lounge room, you know, at my parents' place. Because ABBA was one of those first bands that came out in Australia where parents and kids were united in wanting to listen
in
to the
love
same
of
music.
Benny and Bjorn, is
yeah,
that those guys' names?
It's just amazing. Well, look, ABBA won the 1974 Eurovision Song Contest with Waterloo. It was the song that began their path to worldwide fame. In fact, look, it only made it into the top 10 in the US, but in Australia, it was number one. I mean, that was Waterloo for us, and it was one of the most successful songs ever. It sold 6 million copies, making it basically one of the best selling singles of all time.
I wonder if that's the birth of Australia's love of Eurovision, is that moment with ABBA.
It takes us back to that point where, you know, men and women in the 70s, you know, had a certain degree of equality that we never really achieved. I don't mean social equality. I mean hair equality. We basically all had the same hairstyles. Couldn't tell anyone apart. There's the sort of equality we're looking for in Australia. You surprised me with that sting just to throw me off pace.
Sorry to cut you off on that thought, but from ABBA to something entirely different, Mark. The first Now Showing choice for this week, we're talking about the world of Rocky. Rocky 1 took the world itself by storm, becoming the definitive boxing movie. That was in the late 70s. Then came the rematch with Apollo Creed. That was in Rocky 2. And just when it didn't seem like it could get any more exciting, Mr. T turned up for Rocky 3. Booyah! But then somewhere in the middle of the Cold War, someone thought it'd be a great idea for Rocky to fight Dolph Lundgren, the unforgettable Russian, in the very forgettable Rocky 4. And then there was Rocky, and then there was Rocky 5 and Rocky 6, and et cetera, et cetera. Now, last week, the franchise actually added a seventh film heralding the return of Rocky Balboa to screens. But this new film was called Creed, which is way catchier than Rocky 7. But does it have anything new to offer, Mark? Well, yes, if you count uncommon spiritual insight.
You're not built for this. These boys come in here. They got to fight for life. People die in the ring. Your daddy died in the ring.
I don't know him. Ain't got nothing to do with me. I've been fighting my whole life. It's not a choice for me. Every punch I ever thrown has been on my own. Nobody showed me how to do this. I'm ready.
Creed starts a long way away from where you actually expected to start, rather than being anywhere near a boxing ring. It actually starts in juvenile detention, where you've got a young Adonis, who's Apollo Creed's son, illegitimate son.
His name is Adonis.
Well, I mean, think about it, because Apollo is a Greek god's name, yes. And so is Adonis. So
doesn't make it right, Mark. Doesn't make it right. Okay. But this character's name is Adonis.
I suspect they're trying to suggest that the mother liked, who knows, anyway, it was a mythologist. In juvenile detention.
And it's played by Michael B. Jordan, Adonis, yes.
Well, not at this age, okay, so you've got a young kid. He actually does a bit of a backstory.
Right.
He's a kid who, mum has died, dad has died, he's been bounced from detention center to detention center and foster home to foster home, until Creed's widow, actually his legitimate wife, takes pity on this illegitimate boy and takes her home. Then we flick forward about 15 years and Michael B. Jordan is in the role as Adonis Creed. Okay, and so Adonis basically is doing really well. He's got a great education, he's got a career, he's doing well at a big firm, only he can't get boxing out of his system. He nips off to Mexico on the weekends to fight in sort of, you know, sub-leagues down there.
Oh, like underground matches, that
well,
kind of stuff?
Not so much underground as just like lesser sort of competitions, right, and things like that. And he decides that he really, really, really wants to become a boxer. And that's where Rocky, you know, Sylvester Stallone eventually re-enters the story. He has to be convinced to take on Creed's son.
Of course he does.
On one hand, if you know the backstory to the films, Creed died because Rocky wouldn't take a particular fight.
Oh, that's right. Mr. T. So we've got all that. We've got all that history of the entire Rocky series coming into Creed. But when you were coming in to watch Creed, what were you expecting from this? Like, we're up to the seventh. I thought actually the most recent Rocky Balboa, the sixth one, was actually quite good. But we didn't need any more Rocky films, I didn't think, after that point. Hearing about Creed, my expectations were very low. What about you?
Well, honestly, I was sitting with a bunch of other reviewers and we were laughing in preparation for the film. But in all honesty, sometimes you sit there and you go, I think I'm pretty certain what's about to come at us. And I was incredibly mistaken. This is actually a stunningly good film. You know, if the first three films of the Rocky franchise actually made Rocky, this is a worthy addition. The story is meaningful. It is sensitive. It's actually directed by Ryan Coogler, who worked with Michael B. Jordan on Fruitvale Station.
That was a really little scene, but a highly regarded drama a number of years ago.
If you haven't seen Fruitvale Station, go grab that. And Creed is well worth watching.
But tell me how this is not just another boxing film, because the plot synopsis that you gave us just before sounded to me just like any other boxing film. It actually reminded me of Southpaw that was out earlier in the year. And Southpaw didn't show the upbringing of the character Jake Gyllenhaal played, but he's upbringing was somewhat similar to Adonis Creed, where he was orphaned. He was like from the wrong side of the tracks. He grew up, boxing saved him, etc., etc. I actually quite like Southpaw, but it was still another boxing movie. How is Creed not?
Well, this is boxing is a setting, you know, for often for emotional struggles for characters to come to terms with things. And in this one, it's about fathers, really. It's about trying to connect. There's this weird struggle to try and understand what it is that Michael B. Jordan is trying to get out of this film as the character. What is he trying to gain? And you're not terribly
what
sure.
What is Adonis looking for? Like what?
Yeah, until you reach the sort of, you know, moment in the film where it really becomes clear that this is all about trying to find a way back to a father he never had. It is amazing, and it's really well done.
And Sylvester Stallone's good in this. He must be in some kind of weird father figure.
Yeah, he does.
Weird as in the back history.
He does. And
but how does he go with that?
Well, he introduces a second storyline, in a sense, which is what we are prepared to do for other people. And it becomes then very much a film about death. Now, I don't want to be spoiling the storyline, but Sylvester Stallone has to fight his own battles as Rocky Balboa in this film. And so again, you actually see the film dealing with really serious issues by people who are not, would not present themselves as clear-cut characters, that they're struggling, they've got issues, etc.
So, and not, trying not to give too many things away, but I think what I'm understanding you say is that the Rocky Balboa character is sort of heading towards like what, dying on his own terms? He's that kind of fighter, like he's an individual, he wants to do things his own way.
Yeah, this is a viewpoint for society today, that death, like life, is something that we should be allowed to approach on our own terms. If this is the triumph of individualism in Western society, I've got a right to die as much as I've got a right to live, and how I should do that. And so you can see the groundswell of opinion for people around things like euthanasia. But this film actually reminds us that we just don't live to ourselves. It's not as if my life is mine. My life is part of somebody else's life. My life has implications for everybody around me. And what I really like about this as a Christian is I look at this and I'm reminded that, you know, the Bible says that even though I might not be getting everything out of life that I would like, I am actually living for the sake of other people. That, you know, this life, if it has nothing for me, it might yet have many things that I can do for other people. I mean, the Bible itself talks about the good works that God has prepared for us to do. And in that sense, Creed actually says, look, you know, you have a responsibility to live, not simply because of your own satisfaction, but because of what you might give to other people.
Wow, I am way more interested in Creed than I was about 5 minutes ago. Creed stars Sylvester Stallone, Michael B. Jordan, and Tessa Thompson as a love interest. It's rated M for mature themes, violence, and coarse language, which you're a bit surprised that it didn't actually get a rating for a gratuitous and fairly pointless sex scene from what you're telling me about earlier.
Yeah, there is a scene in there that's like for about 30 seconds that, you know, you want to look away for. I don't know why they had it.
Right. What you won't want to look away from, though, Mark, is the Insights website. Insights, big supporter of the show. Go to insights.uca.org.au. Check out Russ Matthews' review of Creed. I know he was one of the reviewers that you were sitting with.
He's as stunned as I am.
He also was a mockery guy, had to check himself, and came out like punching the air about Creed. So go and check out his thoughts on Creed at Insights website.
One of the most famous novels ever is Moby Dick. But did you know that it was inspired by true events? There actually was a huge whale that attacked and sank a ship called the Essex, a story which author Herman Melville researched before he put pen to paper to create his classic. Well, Oscar-winning director Ron Howard and Thor himself, Chris Hemsworth, reunite to bring this story to the big screen, a tale of high tension on the high seas called In the Heart of the Sea. This ocean adventure sets sail for bravery and death defiance, riding a tide of environmental concerns that briefly docks at huge questions of our place in God's great creation.
A whale. 100 feet long. White as alabaster. A demon.
I want you to tell me what happened.
Looking for the truth about the white whale, Mr. Melville. We were one of the last ships to go out.
All hands on deck!
It was my first time to sea.
What are those pins they're wearing?
They're whale pins, Thomas.
I shall have 12 of those one day.
Yeah, Mark, you're right. This is the story that Moby Dick was based on. It's set in the 1800s. The character Chris Hemsworth's playing is a guy called Owen Chase, who's one of those big burly blokes that's been on boats his whole life and he's earned it. He's like a man's man. He's a salty sea dog.
Yeah.
And he gets he's promised the lead on a ship. But unfortunately, he's passed over by a rich guy played by Benjamin Walker, just this dude who's got a rich dad and can buy his way into anything. So he's the captain of the boat. So there you get set up what's meant to be a tense situation on the boat. So this is the story of this Essex going out hunting for whales and what happens to the crew as it goes after this event, eventually goes after this giant whale. At the same time, it's set around this framing device in this movie of the author Herman Melville, played by Ben Whishaw, who is interviewing one of the last surviving members of the Essex, played by the great actor Brendan Gleeson. So you get a bit of jumping back and forth.
So Brendan's telling the story.
He's telling the story of what, and but basically what we're watching is the story of what happened to the Essex.
Sure. Okay, so you actually had a read of the novel beforehand, didn't you?
So I have attempted to, Mark. So I was trying to compete with you because you're the guy who you actually read books before movies come out. I just choose to see the movie.
I just feel it's important to be well researched. Anyway, so you
I feel it's important to cut to the chase and save my time. So I just want to watch what the movie's got to tell me. But I have been trying to read Moby Dick for the past year, maybe year and a half. I'm about halfway through the book after seeing In the Heart of the Sea. I want to read Moby Dick because I found In the Heart of the Sea so dull, so directionless, so a waste of my time. For anyone who doesn't know, the story of Moby Dick, as much as it's got all these tangents in the novel, which is why it's taken me so long to get through it, it's about 500 pages long, all these tangents about marine life and whale types and boats and all sort of stuff. But the through line is this character, Captain Ahab, who's like arguably the most obsessed guy in the universe ever, who is hunting down this whale who he pretty much says the evils of the world all are focused in this one creature of the deep and I'm going to kill you. That's the story of Moby Dick, which it seems like Herman Melville extracted from the story of the Essex, that essence. And yet when we see what apparently is what happened on the boat of the Essex, you don't have that through line. There's no Captain Ahab character. So Chris Hemsworth and Benjamin Walker, their characters aren't Captain Ahab. There's no through line. There's no purpose to their journey of why they're out on the high seas, not like there is in Moby Dick. And I think with the lack of obsession, with the lack of commentary about how we can be consumed by what we're obsessed by, with the lack of that in the Heart of the Sea, I was just left with this really detached look at a bunch of guys on a boat. It always felt like a movie. I never really felt like I was in danger. I didn't even get the sense of bravery that it would take these kind of men to get on a boat in the 1800s, going out into the wilds of the sea for who knows how long, and all the kind of danger that is ensuing in that. I got no sense of that from this film. And this is a film by Oscar winner Ron Howard. He makes good movies, this man. One of the many issues within the Heart of the Sea is how confusing it gets when you are watching a story of men who are hunting down whales. That's their job. That was a legitimate job at the time. But you get this sort of sense of revision coming in from the filmmakers who don't want to go out as hard against, quote unquote, the animals of the deep.
Is the Moby Dick character, if you like, the big white whale in this, is he Jaws or is he like the misunderstood giant?
Both of those things. And that's one
How does that work?
It doesn't really. And it's one of these many issues in the Heart of the Sea. It doesn't explain why this movie was made. Like when you get all these elements and add them together and walk away, why are we watching this story?
Well, one of the other things, I guess, that you got to put into a context like this is the age in which the people are living. They're obviously pro-whaling. There's no real problem with that when they haven't even discovered oil from the ground yet. So, okay. But what about the idea of belief in God? This is very central to 1800s or 19th century society. How's that handled?
One of the most positive things I've got to say about In the Heart of the Sea, and as you can hear from me, I'm not terribly positive.
You're working hard.
Not terribly positive on it. There's a great scene between the characters Chris Hemsworth and Benjamin Walker play, and Chris Hemsworth is questioning why the events that have transpired, what's happened to their crew, why this has affected them. And he's actually willing to humble himself in front of God and even dare to suggest that we might have brought this on ourselves. Whereas Benjamin Walker takes that more arrogant, superior, quote-unquote, human line of, no, we dominate Earth, we dominate all creatures, we can do whatever we want, and God, he gave us this, and so we should allow ourselves to do whatever we will, and so he could not possibly be punishing us for what's going on here. So In the Heart of the Sea, as much as I didn't like it, I was very struck by that exchange. I wanted some more of that because I love what it was saying about getting us all to think about our place in the world, where God has positioned us, but how we use what we're given for the good, not for the bad, and actually to challenge ourselves in particular situations of what exactly we're doing. That's the really the only strong positive thing I've got coming out of In the Heart of the Sea.
Well fished out. Okay, well, In the Heart of the Sea stars Chris Hemsworth, Benjamin Walker and Cillian Murphy. It has splashed down in cinemas all over the place and is rated M for survival themes. Yes, survival themes are now for mature audiences.
Mm-hmm.
Well, coming up in the next edition of Eternity, actually, you should look out for a review of In the Heart of the Sea, which I understand is really quite good. I understand that because I wrote it. So if you'd like to think a bit more through the film In the Heart of the Sea and the way it actually battles with environmental concerns, check out the Eternity edition coming up.
Now, as you may have fully understood, In the Heart of the Sea, for me at least, failed to really hook any really valuable spiritual insights, let alone anything else. But it's amazing how many fishermen turn out to be at the center of the Christian faith. Like, think about the prophet Jonah. Well, it was a bit more bait than fisherman. Okay, sure. But there's John the Baptist. He spent a great deal of time with his waders on, and he was kind of fishing for people, which is what the 33% of the apostles that Jesus chose did, as in they were actually fishermen, but Jesus sent them out to be fishers of men. So that got us thinking, are fishermen the best people to go to when you want deep insights on life?
Why not?
Well, Mark, this week headed off to Moore Theological College for our press record segment in search of an answer. And he reeled in Dr. Dan Wu, who not only is an expert in the Old Testament and biblical languages, he's an avid angler as well.
Dan, thanks very much for being part of the show.
Yeah, no
now,
worries.
I understand that you are just an epic mind when it comes to things biblical, and we'd just like to know, is it true? Do fishermen really have that sort of insight on life? What have you learned from your fishing experience?
Well, thanks, Mark. I'm not sure if I qualify for your grand lead up. I'm just a simple guy, and I love teaching the Bible, and it's a privilege to be at Moore College doing exactly that. But also being a simple guy, I love fishing, yes. And in some ways I do think fishermen have some sort of insight into the way the universe works that no one else does.
Great. So if I were to ask you for three, let's distill it. Give me three things that fishing has taught you.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, as I think about it, one of the main things that fishing has taught me, I think, is the importance of patience.
Okay. Yeah. Because you don't fish very well, is that...
Maybe not.
Okay.
Probably not. I mean, it's a truism. No matter how good a fisherman you are, an impatient fisherman will go home frustrated and hungry.
Okay, so help me out here. Out of 10, how many times that you go fishing do you come home with nothing?
Well, I would probably say maybe 6 or 7.
Wow, so you're a very patient guy. What else has fishing taught you?
I think fishing has also taught me the importance of friendship, funnily enough. So in the many hours that you spend not catching fish,
okay.
I mean, I enjoy fishing by myself, but some of the highlights in my fishing time have been the times that I spent with friends.
60% of the time, as I understand.
60% of the time, that's right. And so as I think back, some of the most important friendships that I have been formed over endless hours chatting while we wait for a fish to bite.
Okay, what about number three?
Number three, well, actually, I was thinking about this, and yeah, in my capacity, I guess, as someone who teaches the Bible and reads the Bible a lot, fishing is a major theme in the Bible. One of my favourite Psalms talks a lot about how God created everything in the world, and a big part of that is He created the oceans and the fish and the monsters of the deep that are in there that we love to catch. And so it actually talks about that God is good and wonderful for the marvellous creation He's made, a lot of which is very tasty. He's also powerful because of that. He's the creator of the sea. And so often the sea is something that for us humans remains a little bit out of control, a little bit mysterious, very dangerous in some respects. But God in the Bible is the creator and the ruler of the sea. And I think also fishermen feature prominently in the Bible. In Jeremiah, the image of fishermen is used to talk about actually God's judgment of the world. But also, even more importantly, Jesus, as you'll know, chooses fishermen for a lot of his disciples. And he actually says, I'll make you fishers of men, not so much for judgment this time, but actually for salvation. And so it's a way of reminding us that God's intent is to catch us, and not necessarily to kill and eat us, but actually to give us life.
I suspect his strike rate is a lot lower than yours.
A lot higher, hopefully.
Yeah. Hey, Dan, thanks very much for being with us today.
Yeah, no worries, man.
Still to come on the show, what the Bible has to say about competition, Mark, and what I say are the top five movie competitions I do not want to be part of.
Welcome back. Well, singing competitions, boxing competitions, fishing competitions, Moby Dick 1, Ahab 0. It's been a week of competitiveness on the big picture. So why not cap it all off by asking Bible Society Australia's CEO and social commentator Greg Clark if the Bible has anything to say about our hyper-competitive culture?
Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of the other. That's from Philippians chapter 2. Well, a lot of people know that I'm a bit of a fan of the band U2, but not a lot of people know that just how nerdy my interest in the band can be. To prove it to you, I once attended an academic conference in America where professional papers were presented on all manner of themes related to the band. There was U2 and philosophy, U2 and theology, U2 and Christology, that was my one, and even U2 and the practice of queuing at U2 concerts. Yes, a whole study published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Applied Social Psychology, a whole study was done on whether U2 fans queue differently to other fans when they're trying to get into the front of stage area before a show. I'm told Bono inquired about the study because he was hoping that the band's message of love and justice and equality might have had some impact on his fans. And the results confirmed that yes, U2 fans do indeed queue in mysterious ways. Queuing U2 fans value fairness, not just for themselves, but also for others in the line, even when people cut in behind them, for example. And the authors of the study surmise that the fans have a highly developed sense of fairness and want to behave well because, quote, Bono wouldn't like it otherwise. Sure, the Bible does tell us to be ambitious, to do good, to strive to win the prize of heaven, and there are definitely teachings that would urge us not to be lazy, to do our best, to take responsibility, and to make the most of all the good gifts that God has given us. But competitiveness isn't that. It's the negative thing that makes us walk all over other people, glorying in our own abilities, ignoring the grace that's been shown to us. The profound challenge of the Christian faith is to imitate the humility of Jesus, who, in very nature God, was not presumptuous, did not prefer his own interests, and even gave himself to others in the ultimate act of sacrifice. When someone has laid down their life for you like that, your own ambitions do begin to look rather vain and petty. Looking to the interests of others, it has to be the hardest task for selfish human beings. Even noticing the needs of others is a challenge for most of us. But we need to get on with it. You can even get started when you queue up for your next coffee, or supermarket purchase, or rock concert.
So, Mark, to finish up the show this week, from what the Bible has to say about competition...
I don't like to think of it as finishing the show so much as coming to a highlight.
It's
finally reaching the peak of the show. The top five is brilliant.
Well, I would have thought what the Bible has to say about competition would be the peak.
Yeah, yeah.
And now we're just
over the peak.
Entertainingly descending from the peak into what I've got to say about the top five Hollywood competitions that I do not want to take part of.
Five.
Thought I'd go with a simple one, a quick one, right off the bat, The Hunger Games. Bang, there you go.
Let's not be in that.
And I also want to give a massive honourable mention to all the other death games, death sports, death competitions that have been in cinema.
Death Race.
Because The Hunger Games, with its very simple premise in the first one, which it seems like a lot of people got it missed, which is kids trying to kill each other in a competitive game that's televised. But there's been plenty of other movies that have done a very similar thing, including from 1932, there was a film called The Most Dangerous Game, which is some rich guy who got people to shipwreck on an island, and then he just hunted them down for sport. Death Race, Rollerball, Battle Royale was actually The Hunger Games, but a Japanese film. And The Running Man, that Arnold Schwarzenegger film based on a Stephen King book from the late 80s, which does what it says in the title. He's a guy running in this televised arena from death constantly. So... like in The Running Man, like the Battle Royale, but particularly in The Hunger Games, I don't want to participate in that.
You just don't want to be hunted.
Four.
Have you seen Best in Show?
I have.
The film from 2000, a great mockumentary about the insane world of dog owners and pampered pooches. Well, I don't want to be in that competition, Mark. I'm a human. I'm a person. I don't want to be treated as such. But I also just don't want to be in this universe of crazy, outlandish people doing crazy, outlandish things with dogs. So
no. Hang on a second. For those people who do support the show and also happen to love their dogs and compete in shows, we're not talking about you. We're talking about the crazies.
I know. We're talking about this hyper version of yourself. I love dogs as well. But come on, like the lengths that people would go to. No, thank you very much. But that's not quite as scary to me, a competition as...
Three.
The 2002 documentary Spellbound, that was about the American Spelling Bee competition, the National Spelling Bee competition, where really smart kids would get up on stage, they're given a word, and they have to spell it. I don't want to participate in that competition. Professionally, I'm a person who's been paid to write and to communicate for a long period of time, but I am terrified about stepping up next to a 9-year-old who knows the dictionary inside their head and knows how to spell clavicin correctly, which actually is spelled C-A-L-A-V-E-C-I-N. See, I'm reading it out and I can't even spell it. C-L-A-V-E-C-I-N. I would have got kicked out. And like the kid in Spellbound, Harry Altman, who you can see his mind getting wrapped up into knots when he's trying to spell a word, bands. He doesn't know how to spell bands. I don't know how to spell bands. It's spelled with a double N, B-A-N-N-S.
As in the reading of the bands, like as in wedding bands.
Is it? I don't know. This is why I don't want to compete, Mark. This is why I don't want to do it.
Two.
There have been a lot of competition movies about dancing. You know, movies like Step Up or Bring It On, that kind of movie. And they compete in all kinds of hip-hoppery and that sort of stuff in these movies. I don't really want to participate in those. I used to be a bit of a dancer, Mark. I'm sure you can believe this. In my youth.
Your dancing figure.
But I had that kind of male groove going on where you just put your head down and you kind of shuffle on the spot.
I believe they call that the white man's overbite.
I was amazing at the white man's overbite for some time. I could really feel the deep bass moving inside me. That time has come though. I'm not much of a dancer anymore. So as much as I want to be in those kind of movies, I really, really don't want to be in the dancing competition that was in They Shoot Horses, Don't They? From 1969. Have you seen this film?
No, I haven't. But
more people should see this film. It's amazing. It stars Jane Fonda and it's directed by Sidney Pollack. They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Not only is it this memorable title, it's a black and white movie worth going back to, set in the Great Depression, allegedly based on real events, where there were people, because people needed money so desperately and people were looking for entertainment as well, putting the two things together, people organized these massive dance spectaculars that you would go and watch. There were these dance marathons happening in arenas, and then people would just show up, and it was basically you had to dance until you're the last dancer standing. But this is about exploiting people's need and pitting them against each other. That's what you see in They Shoot Horses, Don't They? I don't want to be part of that, but that doesn't freak me out, Mark, anywhere near as much as what's coming in at number one.
One.
It's difficult to talk about this movie, Mark, without giving the game away. And I'm talking about The Game from 1997. Yeah, I'm not as much of a spoiler guy, so I'm going to try to do this as cautiously as I possibly can for anyone who hasn't seen it, because it's a great movie.
Spoil it.
And you should check it. Okay, Michael Douglas is a rich guy, Nicholas. He's got everything that you could possibly want, apart from maybe meaningful relationships. His estranged brother, Conrad, who's Sean Penn, shows up and gives him this really weird birthday present. It's a voucher for a game. It's nondescript. He doesn't really know what the game is. It's run by the Consumer Recreation Services. And his brother says it's going to change his life. Nicholas, he's rejected for the game. So he goes along, does this, goes to this appointment. They say, nah, mate, we're not going to take you in. He gets a bit annoyed at that, Nicholas, as you'd expect. But then to make matters worse, from that point on, the major parts of his life, like business and savings and reputation, just go downhill.
Everything.
Like rapidly.
Gets
like
trashed.
Everything just goes downhill very, very fast. Okay, here's the bit where I start revealing what's going on in this movie. And he's in fact now a part of a game, and he's a part of a game where his whole life is the game. And what seems to be happening is the game is about endangering your life or taking away everything from your life, and not just taking it away, but doing it in a way where you feel like there's nothing left to live for.
Yes.
So this is the bit why it's coming in at number one for me, and why I really don't quite understand what was going on with that choice as a birthday present from your brother. Why would I want to participate in a competition where it seems like everyone and everything in your life that you love or that you liked is being turned against you, and apparently that's fun.
It's too much like real life. why would you actually want to play this?
But apparently it's meant to spice up your life and make you want to embrace living.
Oh, my life is so uninteresting, I need somebody to victimize me.
I know, right? So coming at number one on the top five Hollywood movie competition I don't want to be part of is The Game, mainly because I already like life enough. I don't need someone to challenge me about that. Take everything away from me and rub that in my face.
Consumer Recreation Services.
Call that number.
Why?
They make your life fun.
What are you selling?
It's a game.
A game?
Specifically tailored for each participant.
John, chapter 9, verse 25. Whereas once I was blind, now I can see. Now I can see.
One day your game begins. You either love it or hate it.
Are you going to spend the rest of the evening prying at that clown's mouth?
Mr. Van Orton, is everything all right?
Well, Mark, let the games begin, but not for me.
Nope, don't want to play.
No, okay, so that well, was this week. What's coming up next week?
Coming up next week. Well, it's our Boxing Day special next week.
That was me doing a sound effect. Yeah, we should get more sound effects.
Something for the young, something for the not so young.
We've also got dinosaurs, it's going to be women's rights, and the history of Boxing Day movies all in the one show. And I think even for that Boxing Day special, avast me hearties, I am going to be Ben McKechnie.
And I'm still Mark Adley. See you then.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.